I'm going to reflect a bit on love and different qualities of love, different kinds of love. And then Jean is going to kind of carry that into how we embody love and kindness in our lives, and a little bit more about practice. So, practice in daily life. So, you know, when we say love, like, it's a big word, right? We might mean a lot of things, and we use it in many different ways. You know, people say, "I love chocolate," and I do. But it's not the same as you know, the kind of love that we've been reflecting on, loving kindness, loving friendship that we've been reflecting on. So, but we can talk about sensual love. So, kind of pleasant experiences that we, and a lot of what we call love is based on sensual attraction, right? People fall in love, and a lot of it has to do with feeling attracted, finding the other person that they're connecting with, and opening their heart to, pleasing in many different ways. And so, you know, we can say we love a place, you know, a place that we live, or a place that we visit, or and so all of these are based on pleasant, sensual experiences. And so, you know, we talked about these feeling tones of pleasant and unpleasant and neutral. So when a feeling of love or liking something is based on pleasant sensual experiences, when we don't experience that as pleasant, then we no longer like or love that person or place or experience, right? So, you know, relationships fall apart pretty quickly when they're based on just pleasant sensual experiences, because, you know, maybe we're looking for, you know, something different or something new, or we get bored, or something changes about the person or the place or the experience that it's no longer pleasant, as things tend to change, and as our feelings change. You know, and we're not in control of feelings. Feelings change. They're conditioned, they arise, they fall. And what we feel, what we experience as pleasant in one moment may be, you know, unpleasant or just kind of neutral. And even neutral, you know, doesn't kind of hold us, grab us, or we don't grab it as much because it doesn't have that, you know, we're not drawn to it. So it's not to say that sensual, pleasant feelings are bad. Not at all. I'm not saying that. But just to realize, to recognize and know that pleasant, sensual feelings are impermanent and unstable. The conditions that we experience as unpleasant are unstable, and the feelings themselves are also unstable. And then, you know, emotional love is another kind of love. And it also is based on feelings. So we feel emotionally comfortable. We feel emotionally pleasant. We enjoy being with somebody. Maybe we find them entertaining or funny, or we feel accepted or feel close to them. And so emotional love is, it's more, it has more depth because our emotions are, you know, are very much, they're complex, they're very deep, and they're part of who we are. And so emotional love is something that is, it's more developed because when we feel emotional love for somebody, we, you know, it's meeting certain kinds of needs that we personally have, and we may be meeting the needs of the other. And also emotions change, right? Emotions come and go. What our emotional needs are at a particular time in our life may not be the same as what they become at a later point in our life. So it may be that, you know, at one point in my life I might have, and I'm just using the first person just to, as a figure of speech, I'm not really talking about myself. But in one part of my life, I might have wanted somebody who would really take care of me, you know, that I felt that I was being taken care of because maybe I hadn't had that in my upbringing, you know. Maybe I hadn't been really cared for. But then a later point in my life, and maybe partly thanks to the nurturance of this person, I feel more independent, I feel more strong, more confident, and this caring and taking care of becomes, I can do it myself, you know. So we change. That's when emotional flexibility and listening and being attentive and being able to adapt and change is so important in a relationship. And then we could say a third kind of love is this metta, you know, which is sometimes called unconditional love. So in that it's not based on conditions. So it's really, we've been expressing it in so many beautiful ways, so many wonderful words to describe this real just caring for the well-being of someone without any agenda for ourselves. You know, it's not about me. It's about really wanting this person to flower as who they are, wanting this person to develop, to grow spiritually, to be free from suffering, to be free from the bonds that, you know, of reactivity and greed, hatred, and delusion. And so there's this caring which is really just, you know, in the New Testament, there are words like love as God loves, like the rain falling on the earth. You know, so the rain doesn't decide, where to fall. The sun doesn't decide where to shine. So it's this, just this kind of another image for this is like a flower which just gives off its scent, not deciding, you know, who will smell it or who will enjoy it, or even just, you know, if anyone enjoys it. So our human love is a weaving through of all of these kinds of love. You know, it could be sensual love, and very often, you know, in I'm talking specifically for this moment about partner relationships, you know, and until now I was talking about it, any kind of relationship, could be friendship, it could be, you know, a child, a parent, so on. But, you know, in partner relationships, very often when we're young, you know, the sensual part is stronger, you know, like that's a more important dimension. Maybe it becomes less emphasized as, you know, our bodies change and the senses are not so powerful, the hormones are not so powerful in our bodies. And the emotional love, you know, it's nourished by listening to the other, by extending ourselves to understand the other, to try to understand where they're coming from, you know, and not, you know, we may have our preferences, we have our emotional wants and needs, and so you know, sometimes when we don't get that pleasant emotional feeling, you know, because our wants and needs are not being met, it might be because something's going on with the other, you know, and so we might need to, you know, inquire into the relationship. You know, what's going on? You know, you seem just, you don't seem to be kind of so present, or I'm not finding the right words, but yeah, you seem maybe a little bit down today, you know, or maybe detached or something, or maybe there are more tactful ways of saying that, but to just inquire into what's going on with the other, rather than, you know, judging or feeling disappointed or pulling back because, you know, our own emotional needs are not being met in the same way. And we all do have these needs, these needs to be received, this need to be nourished, this need to be seen, the need to be recognized as who we are and encouraged. You know, we need that. We need friends. We need people who care for us. And a lot of us didn't get much of that when we were young. And so as we move into relationships as adults, we're wanting it, and yet at the same time, you know, it's the empathy and the understanding and the being, you know, kind of light in carrying expectations into relationships. It's really a dance, right? It's really a dance. All kinds of relationships are a dance, and in dancing we have to pay attention so we don't, you know, push somebody over or step on their toes. I just want to tell a very short story just to close this. There's so much just that could be said about this, and we want to, you know, Jean, I want to hear what Jean has to say, and we also want to hear what your questions are. Joanna Macy is the woman who developed this practice that Jean led us through. It was actually a putting together of two of her exercises that she's done some brilliant work to develop trust and openness and courage and an ability to hold the suffering of the earth in our hearts, because she's a woman who's both a Buddhist, a Dharma teacher, and a deep ecologist and activist. And she told a story once about her relationship with her husband, who was then her fiancé, and they had decided to get married. And so they went to a friend of theirs who was also a minister. And they asked him for his blessing, and to also perform the ceremony, sometime in the future. And as they were talking together, he said, "Well, the blessing I want to give you right now is, may you always be strangers to each other." Mm-hmm. Which, you know, was like, but when you think about it, they don't assume that you know who that person is in this moment. Don't assume that you know that you know that they are the person that they were the day before, that what they're feeling is what you expect them to feel, how they respond to any particular set of conditions is how they've responded in the past. So just be open and be receptive and attentive to who they are in this moment. And of course, we have the history and what we've built together in friendships and in all our relationships. And that needs to be balanced with just, you know, that freshness of being able to receive the person in this moment without knowing, with the attitude of not knowing. Pass it to Jean.
We're at the clock.
Yes. I'm sitting with such deep appreciation for the Buddha. You know, the Buddha, when I like to reflect on the Buddha as this human being, because he was this human being who was determined. You know, determination is one of those paramis, those virtuous qualities that Janet was referring to, that determination for liberation of the heart and mind. There's something that's quite inspiring about that, just a human being saying, you know, I am going to steadfast in whatever way I can understand and liberate the heart and mind. Then just undertook that, you know, amidst people who criticized him. You know, it's kind of easy to sort of idolize a spiritual teacher, but when you think of any spiritual seeker that has some fame, you know, Christ included, you know, they weren't necessarily the most popular beings on the block. You know, it's not, you know, there was people who criticized, you know, them and, you know, who, I mean, it takes this kind of steadfast courage, doesn't it? As well as that balance of vulnerability to listen, really. To listen. I mean, it's been such a joy to be here with all of you and to be part of and to bear witness and to help facilitate that, many practices of how we can wake up our minds and hearts. And it's kind of endless. That's what made me think about the Buddha, because there's the Buddha and Daryl, you know, sharing these teachings, and I'm sitting here and, you know, just as you're ending, reflecting on my relationship with my brother when you said, don't assume you know someone. You know, someone who I've always wanted, it was just the two of us, and wanted over the course of our, you know, 60-something years of knowing each other, you know, wanted more closeness. And a number of years ago, you know, I realized there was a screen, you know, because I wanted something from him that I didn't think I was getting. And we're different, you know, we're different. He would, you know, in years past, he might have even thought Buddhism was a cult. He's an engineer. He's much more introverted. And there's just been this delicious dropping into just what you were speaking to, Daryl, that opening of the not knowing and noticing in that, in like letting go of the I want or he isn't or I am, you know, because it goes back and forth, you know, I'm too much, he's not coming forward, whatever. But just this like seeing, you know what I'm talking about, right? I think you're laughing because you know what I'm talking about. There's just this like experiencing of his sweetness, and it's so delicious. You know, there's something so beautiful about like getting to know him anew, you know, inside, you know. And I probably wouldn't go to him and say, oh, I'm just noticing your sweetness, you know. You know, but it's there. And just along with what I was speaking about in that, in my talk, of just that reflection of death, you know, that the other way I just comes, it arises naturally, is just thinking I don't know when I won't have him. So that also awakens the heart to pay attention in the moment, to actually appreciate the moment together, even if it isn't like unfolding the way I might like. You know, not because there's any sort of ill will there. They're different people. So I love the invitation, Daryl, that you're inviting us to, in terms of going into our worldly life, which is just a bit of what I wanted to speak about, that there's a certain, not to be intimidated by this, but those of you that have sat in retreats, there's a certain skill, so to speak, or a certain navigation in transitioning out of a retreat, whether it's, you know, 2 days or 3 weeks or a month or 3 months. I know, Janet, you've sat many, many months. So, you know, you had that experience of transitioning into a really different realm. And even when it's just a couple of days, sometimes you don't even know how sensitive you are. You don't know it until you walk into the grocery store or, you know, you attend a gathering maybe, or you're on the telephone, or you're greeting a family member. And, you know, in my own experience, as I said in my talk, you know, sometimes that can be just kind of sublime. I mean, I've left retreats before and gone to a party and found myself, you know, feeling this great love for people, you know, and then other times just like, you know, feeling like you're on drugs walking into a grocery store and you're just like, get me out of here, you know. So it's, again, it's listening to your own being. Now some of you, you know, may be parents or you know, have responsibilities, probably most all of us, that you're going back to. So, you know, you may not have the kind of space that you've had on retreat. But I was thinking about this when I was reading and offering Joanna Macy's beautiful interpretation of the Brahmaviharas when you're in the labyrinth, and you probably heard me say, really take the time in the in-between. Because I was imagining, you know, myself, I've done that exercise, you know, more than once, where, you know, you can feel such a mix of things, sometimes like just open-hearted with, when you're with someone, and just that easefulness of just letting the words drop in, feeling it in your heart. Then another moment, you'd be like, ugh, you know, this is hard, or I can't quite feel it, or I can't wait till she rings the bell. You know, and then that is the moment, that is such a perfect moment to not judge. Not judge. Because it's just arising. You know, we get all caught up. Like you said, the flower doesn't decide, hey, how do I look? You know, you know, or maybe she's going to like me or he's not going to like me. It just is. It just flowers of its own, as Galway Connell says, self-blessing. It just is. It has its bud. When we were looking at the buds in the group walking, the peonies, they're so tight. And you know, they're just full of this huge promise, you know, and then they have their life and then they die. You know, that this is our nature, you know, and we are born and we die moment to moment. We're born and we die in our flourishing. You know, I look at people who are older than me as well as I watch my own aging. And certain things they're letting go of that they're not able to do anymore, like kayaking, bike riding. It's kind of like a wake-up call. Like, yeah, that's happening here too. You know, I might not be there yet, but here's this flourishing and waning. And life is like that. So if we have these moments where our heart is closed, you just think of it like sometimes a flower closes at night. I mean, we don't have to make a big deal out of it. We can actually bring kindness, you know, or use the sounds of nature, the bell, to wake us up to, it's okay, this is how it is. This is how it is right now. And that, my friends, is so not a passive process. You know, oftentimes, you know, I like to connect with political activists, and I think it's so juicy bringing the Dharma and politics together. You know, and oftentimes, you know, the question will be, well, you know, that's, you know, what about doing something? It's kind of passive. And my own experience, it's so the opposite. It's like when we can drop into our own being and allow our own being, like, true nourishment. So nourishment of mindfulness, nourishment of rest, nourishment of nature. You know, nourishment in the ways we take care of our bodies. Of course, totally imperfect, right? Get this, you know, perfect idea. It's not like that. We do the best we can. But in that nourishment, which includes, if you can, coming on retreat, you know, as often as you can. Not because you should, just because you have that desire, that inclination, that intention. Great. Follow it. You know, it's like we look at how we take care, we brush our teeth every day, you know, we take showers. When do we cleanse the mind and heart? You know, a retreat offers that. You know, why? Because it's an intensive. Because it you know, we refrain from our cell phones or newspapers or phones or, you know, details of life. Not that those things are bad. We just seclude ourselves. We have this intensive focus to cultivate these qualities of mindful awareness, of loving kindness, of equanimity. You know, and so, you know, it can be a misunderstanding of practice that, okay, now it's all going to be so easy. It's not like that. You know, we sometimes open to really deeply painful aspects of life or in ourselves. And it takes that spiritual warrior, so to speak, that courageous heart that can come close and say, I see you. I see you right now. You know, I'm receiving right now what's coming out of my mind and heart. This is not something I'm sharing with you because I've perfected this by any stretch of the imagination. You know, it takes so much to be fully alive on one level. And another level, once we can really drop into ourselves, it becomes more easeful. It's like the only thing we can do. It becomes more painful to act or think unskillfully. It's not like it disappears, but we see it more. And we're able to relate to it more with equanimity, but also with intention, as I was saying in the talk, of just noticing sometimes if my speech feels off in some way, it just doesn't quite feel right, and I can feel this, you know, unsettled. I might need to correct it or speak to another person about it. Or, you know, to me, where the rubber meets the road is the speech towards myself. And that's, you know, that's a little more challenging. You know, the conditions being what they are, you know, growing up with strong work ethic parents, good people, you know, really good people, and people have talked about their parents here, you know, but perhaps a little bit hard on around that kind of work ethic. And so then one internalizes that, is like that's what makes you good. You know, what you produce, what you do, you know, kind of a perfectionism. Like, life isn't like that. You know, sometimes the energy is low, or sometimes there's feelings of pain or dissatisfaction. You know, can we bring that attentive, caring, allowing with respect to how it is? And from that place, you know, action does arise. Back to my commentary about the, you know, political activists. It's almost a fear. Like, if you slow down and pay attention, you're just going to be like, ugh. You know, it's not like that, is it? I mean, think about the effort it takes just to be on a two-day retreat. It takes effort, doesn't it? It's like, I don't feel like going in the hall. I don't want to do that. I don't want to walk on, you know. just want to, you know, go get some ice cream, or, you know, drive my car to go get a burger. Yeah, I don't even eat meat, but I know people have left retreats to get burgers. You know, but it's just like that effort it takes to show up. And then, to, you know, to feel the balance in that. So now we're showing up for this transition into our lives, you know, as they unfold. And even though, you know, you might think you know, we really don't know. We have no idea what's going to happen next. So, you know, with the same spirit of how we meet other people, can we meet life that way? Like, okay, it's unfolding. Can we trust that rooting in our beings? So, you know, as I was saying, let yourself root in between the contact when you're out in the labyrinth. Yeah, I could really feel the power of that in my own body. Like, that's so necessary. That in-between is so necessary. And it's hard in our culture. I think for me, I notice it's hard to sometimes give myself that out of habit. You know, it's like, oh, I have to get this done, I have to get that done, that done. So, you know, to really, if that's where your working edge is, to do your best, to take the time as you can. Now, for me, sometimes what I'll do, honestly, the way as I've practiced mindfulness, my office is on the second floor, I'm reminding myself this, step. I just connect with the moment. I do that a lot. Like, connecting with the body is, like I said earlier, is very tangible. So you can really strengthen your mindfulness practice in those simple ways. Noticing contact. Noticing your hand on the wheel. Noticing your hand on the door. You know, noticing your hand with the toothbrush when you're washing the dishes. You know, these daily repetitive tasks that you just start to, you know, your mind will be, I got to do this, I got to do that. And then suddenly you just feel the sensation of the doorknob. It's like, drop into it, feel it. You know. Or another practice for me, I have a dog, I like to walk in the woods. Beautiful woods, beautiful dog, river, trees. And I can go for like 20 minutes and realize I haven't noticed anything. And when my mind notices that in the moment of mindfulness, it's not about what did you do, just drop, okay, now this moment is a moment of awakening. So we notice that moment and we can drop into the present. Notice the touch, you know, of the earth. Notice what we're seeing, hearing, seeing. And then it's so cool because of the dog that I start to notice my dog, Rosie, and she just like delights, you know, in everything around her. And she kind of wiggles and she has this little prance. And it's like, I was like, it's like waking up. Like I was just asleep. I missed this, you know, delight. So I might notice that for a while. Then I might go back to thinking, planning, whatever. I mean, you know, sometimes walks are good for... I actually, a lot of my Dharma talks come when I'm walking. So it's not to then negate the time we need for contemplation, but it's actually about how do we take time, and can we take time? So another thing for myself, besides when I can sitting in meditation, is also just going to sleep at night, really using that as a mindfulness, loving kindness practice, feeling the sheets, feeling the pillow. Okay, we could do a whole retreat for sleep issues, right? I mean, it's incredible how many people have sleep issues, including teenagers, I have to say. It's so painful to hear. A lot of teenagers struggle with sleep. So if you have the blessing of easeful sleep, great. And if you don't, you still do the same thing. Just feel the contact of the bed underneath you, the coolness of the sheets or the warmth of the sheets or the sounds outside of you. Like, just drop into that mindfulness practice. You know, turn off the devices. Maybe do that even earlier than you usually do. And maybe just generate some loving kindness for yourself. You know, as you're getting ready to... You know, sleep is another transition. It's just dropping into this letting go. So that's a time we can practice loving kindness, mindfulness. And I think these, you know, again, I could spend a lot of time talking about the commitment to non-harm. You know, these practices, these mindfulness trainings that we undertook at the beginning of the retreat, how do we carry them, you know, into our lives? So, you know, what we water bears fruit, you know, and what we let dry up will dry up. So, and that's its own balance and its own process. So watering the seeds of self-kindness, patience, equanimity, meaning, you know, just a mental note, like things are as they are, forgiveness, patience. I think I said that. I said it again. This, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, I'm committed to non-harm. It's just that increasing awareness to what cultivates happiness. You know, cultivating these wholesome qualities of generosity, you know, forgiveness, kindness, equanimity. These are the fuel and seeds of happiness. And I guess the final thing I would say about that is that if there's something that you noticed on retreat that came up for you, whether it, you know, sometimes it can come up as, for myself, like a working edge. Like, per se, you notice irritation come up a lot, or self-judgment, or spacing out. So rather than judging it, one could make the intention post-retreat, I'm just going to try to notice that a little more. I'm just going to try to work my edge with that. Or just notice when ill will arises, whether it's towards self and another. And notice how the mind relates to it. Can it relate to it with compassion? To feel the pain of it? You know, rather than get so identified with it and tell yourself you're a bad person, it doesn't really lead to anything but more of that, quite honestly. It's habit. So we have to, you know, as we notice whatever habits are that don't lead to happiness, it takes that perseverance and patience. Just come towards it. Don't be afraid of it. And when the mind judges, Joseph Goldstein used to say, you know, I just count the judges. This is judgment 579. You know, it's not really that personal. It's conditioned mind. You know, so we don't have to make a big deal out of it. You know, wanting it to go away is identifying with it as much as believing it. So with that, enjoy the fruits of your practice and take some time for yourself if you can. And make your life a blessing, because it is.
I have some questions.
Sure.
So we'll take some, you know, we'll have a few minutes for questions. If anybody has something that came up for you in the talks or coming out of your practice or about going back into your ordinary life and how to bring this into your life.
This is a bit of a technical question, but I wondered if you could talk a bit about the difference between metta and karuna. And because, you know, I suppose I've had the idea that possibly metta, loving kindness, is more in action. And compassion is more a feeling. But recently I asked somebody about compassion, and they described it, and this was in an aspect, he described compassion as noticing something in another and wanting at the same time to alleviate something. And I'm just wondering what your take on differentiating loving kindness from compassion is.
I can speak to that. The way I understand it is that you know, the quality of metta is this open heart and wishing well to all beings, wanting them to thrive and be well and at peace and so on. And compassion is how that love expresses itself when we see a being in pain and suffering. And so coming from that quality of caring, we want to alleviate the pain and the suffering of somebody. And we can't always alleviate their pain and suffering. But we can, you know, for me, in the essence of compassion in toward ourselves and toward another is that we don't turn away. We attend. So we so often turn away from ourselves when we're in pain, when there's grief or fear or judgment. You know, we turn away from that because it's unpleasant. You know, we don't want to be with it. We don't want to experience it. And so the compassion is to say, I care about this and I'm going to stay present with it. And then with another, we also find it hard to be with somebody who may be, you know, in grief or in confusion. And so compassion is I care about this and I stay with it, and perhaps in that attention, in giving that attention, something skillful will, you know, appear in my mind, in my awareness, that I can do to reach out, to alleviate the pain, to support this person or being in their suffering. And we don't know. We can't expect, you know, that's when compassion, you know, if sometimes people's compassion can feel like too much if they're trying to fix everything for us, you know, and you know, we can't fix everything. And at the same time, you know, the presence of somebody can be so supportive. Just that saying, you know, I know, well, we can't know what they're feeling, but they can know that they're in pain, we can know that they're in pain. And so that willingness to connect. And I think also, you know, what Jean was saying earlier about activism, you know, we see so much suffering and so much harm in the world around us. And so, opening to compassion, having that courage of compassion, you know, to not just close down, to fold, to say, oh, it's too much, you know, it's too big, it's hopeless, I can't do anything, but to continue to care, you know, to keep an open heart, and to say, I can do this. You know, I can respond in this way. This is what's calling me. This is what I feel, how I feel I need to respond. And it's amazing how, you know, we can connect with others and that response of kindness and caring can do a lot.
Just to add something quick to that, in Buddhist teaching, compassion is often spoken of as the natural arising from wisdom. So wisdom tells us, here's the human condition. You know, we've been talking the whole retreat about, you know, what's, you know, you can't, there's just an insecure reality because life is changing all the time. So that this compassion is the natural heart's response. It's just a natural arising. You know, you don't even have to cultivate it. It's a natural arising of the heart's understanding of human suffering. You know, whether we act from that or not is completely conditional on the circumstance. But the heart itself will feel that compassion. It's often called the quivering of the heart, and that it has the power that even a fly landing on the heart, you would feel it. You'd feel the fly. You know, so it's what comes from that is who knows? It's going to vary, but it's the heart's knowing and the heart's feeling of the truth of life, really. Its near enemy is pity. Which, as Daryl was saying, that's a kind of a, oh, that's you, not me. You know, it's actually knowing, hey, I'm there too.
I'm wondering if you could speak to the aspect of no self. Just like doing a little bit of reading on it, and I can grasp the concept, but I lose it very quickly as soon as I'm in relation or in my roles that I'm so attached to, in a sense, right? That I identify myself with. And how to, I guess, let some of that go, or maybe just even talk a little bit to the concept of no self to help with, you know, maybe less comparing and less of that identifying with my roles, teacher, wife, or whatever.
The ego, you know, ego isn't a bad thing. We need our ego. We have our identities, you know. You're Billy, I'm Jean, that's Daryl. There's Lynn over there. You know, I mean, it would be a little bit of a psychotic world if we didn't have that. Not a little, it would be. So it's actually the conceptual mind really wants to understand no self. You are not alone. This is like a very common question. It can't. It cannot get it. It's beyond that because, you know, one way to enter into it, I love how Joseph Goldstein talks about this because it's so simple. It's so Joseph. He says, you know, when you look at the Big Dipper, is it really the Big Dipper? Big Dipper's just a word. You know, and even if you say, well, it's a grouping of stars, that's another concept. There's no way to really describe what we call the Big Dipper. So we live in a relative world where we're going to say, you know, you're Billy and, you know, you've been teaching Kundalini Yoga. I mean, it's like that's not something to get rid of. But it's just to recognize that, and it's all changing, including as we sit here, what is going on underneath what we call skin? I mean, it's like mind-blowing. You know, it's all moving and changing, but we'll call it a self. Even our thoughts change, our identities change, our feelings change. You know, it's this combination of elements coming and going. So the teaching is essentially to break through this idea of separation and over-identification. And it's a practical way to understand the teaching. I mean, it has so much more meaning, but that's a practical way. So if you're trying hard to get it, you know, I would contemplate more the nature of change, and that will help you understand. Does that make sense?
And then just quickly, the second question I have is any suggestions for, I have preteens, teenagers, trying to teach them some of these concepts, just because I'd like to see them grow up with some of these tools that maybe we didn't have. And I wonder if you have any suggestions.
How old are they? Come to the States, come to the teen retreat. We start our teen retreats at 14. You live in Ottawa? I would imagine there are teen programs. Is there anything, Janet, that you know of?
It's maybe not.
Maybe but there's another calling, Billy.
there's so many. It's a really growing area for books and, you know, talks. There's a lot that you can find and on the, you know, like in terms of information and ideas and like little things that you can do with your kids to help just develop their capacity to be present, you know, to attend. And that's really something that I think a lot of parents are concerned about because, you know, with all these little devices and screens and, you know, like we have, you know, our kids are growing up with very short attention spans. And I think it's something to be discovered as to how the psyches of the generation of kids growing up with all this screen time is going to develop. But you know, doing things like taking a walk in nature and just helping them to be present, you know, to their surroundings.
What I found most helpful in community is actually groups. So if you know of any Dharma teachers in the area who have done any kind of work with teens or mindfulness practitioners, leaders, teens respond really well to groups. And many times parents will come to me and say, I really want my teenager to go on the teenage retreat. They won't listen to me. Most parents have that experience. You know, parents that are well connected to their kids. So I wouldn't worry about that, but I might think about who do you know that you might be. As a matter of fact, I just did this in my area. Just a parent called me and said, could you come, could we plan a time? And I went for, you know, 2 or 3 hours with 5 14-year-olds. Mm-hmm. And as Daryl said, there's many tools online. When I first started working with kids, there wasn't anything, very little. But there's some good books. Blue Jean Buddha is one, where teens have written their own little articles. But there's mindfulness practices. But quite honestly, I think it's hard. You're not going to get, I don't know you and your children, but it's not easy to get mileage that way. But if you call together a group, have some pizza, and have someone lead some mindfulness practices with them, it's amazing how responsive kids are to Dharma practice. And I actually mean Dharma practice, not just mindfulness techniques, but the insights they have, the openness they have. And I totally agree with Daryl, it's such a ripe time to support our youth. So I really mean it. If you have that desire, I would rally someone you know and you know, just ask, you know, and the, you know, if the kids are together, they'll do it. And what I did with that was I just had the parents go and do their own thing. And I met with the kids, and then we came together and shared. And I had the parents do some of the same practices. And then we shared about it. So there's a lot of really creative ways to do it.
I started my daughter on the guided.
Yeah.
At night,
yes, they love that. There's a lot of apps, actually. Yeah. There's some apps for teens that you can just put the earplugs in, helps them with sleep, or preteens, too. There's stuff for kids, too. Chris Willard's work is quite great.
Sorry,
Chris Willard, W-I-L-L-A-R-D. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Maybe one more question.
Just Billy, mm-hmm. Yes, you may want to check Nakhera Shanti.
I did my training there.
Okay, so I noticed that sometimes they have a program for children. It might just be a weekend, but it could be an inn.
Okay.
And there's also Shandala that has programs as well. It may or may not fit your needs, but it might be good.
Trust your instinct to want that, because I mean, you know, with IMS, we've had kids that have come on the family retreat, and some of them are Dharma teachers now.
They
had that exposure.
How old do they have to be to go to IMS on a retreat?
The teen retreat is 14 to 19.
Yeah. But they still have a family retreat?
No.
They don't do a family retreat.
No, but Washington, D.C. does. But, yeah, we can talk more about it, yeah.
Other questions?
One
more question,
maybe? I have one, but it's not too long.
during the metta practice, and you gave us phrases to say. One of them was, may I be free from suffering, and then you expanded on that, so may I be free from the root causes of suffering, which are greed, hatred, and delusion. And I certainly know and have experienced greed, and I know and have experienced aversion and hatred. Delusion is still a fuzzy concept for me.
Yeah.
Can you give a definition of what that means?
Yeah, well, delusion can take many forms. Can just manifest as confusion. So, like, really, you know, feeling like not grounded, spaced out, zoned out. Confusion can also take the form of ideology, like that we believe strongly in this idea, and we close our minds to, you know, a reality that might be completely in contradiction to the idea. So that's delusion, you know. So people who are very, very ideological, you know, politically or, you know, even religiously, you know, like fundamentalism, you know, it's a kind of delusion. And also... it's kind of a fogginess or darkness, and so, you know, and the essential delusion that, you know, is kind of at the root of it all is that, you know, I am this permanent, separate, independent self, you know, not connected. You know, not conditioned by, you know, what's going on, that somehow I am in control. So that's kind of the essential delusion, and then the grasping and the hatred actually arise from that, you know, fundamental ignorance of who we truly are.
So, you know, we wanted to
just spend a little bit of time on forgiveness, because forgiveness is a really important practice in our, you know, evolving our spiritual unfolding. When we're holding anger and resentment, we're really closing our heart, and so it's something that is really, I think, important as we move it back into our lives and all of our connections, to reflect on forgiveness. Just to start in this context of this retreat, we felt that it would be helpful to do a short forgiveness contemplation, because we've been in relation with each other a lot, and we might have, you know, inadvertently said or done something or acted in some way you know, affected somebody so that they felt excluded or felt harmed or or disrespected. So first of all, you know, as teachers, Jean and I want to ask your forgiveness. If in any way anything that we have said has harmed you, has created harm, has created confusion, and also we offer you our forgiveness for anything that you might have done, intentionally or unintentionally, knowingly or unknowingly, to do something harmful toward us. And then toward one another. First of all, we need to forgive ourselves again and again and again for the ways that we forget, for the ways that we may react, for the ways that we may wish ill toward others. We need to forgive ourselves for any anger or guilt, you know, that we may be holding toward ourselves for things we've done in the past. And that is a process that we can intentionally enter into to reflect on our lives and ask ourselves, you know, ethically, is there anything that I have done, you know, to have harmed another? I went through a whole ethical process of reflecting on harm that I've done, and I remembered that I had borrowed some money from somebody and never paid it back, and I had gone away. And I had always held that in my heart as something I felt bad about. I felt was a fault. I felt really sorry about it. And so I decided to contact this person that I hadn't seen in 30 years and said, I have $100 that I want to give back to you. And we met. And he said, I don't want the $100. But he remembered. He had remembered the event. And it was healing for both of us to do that. So forgiveness can bring us into this kind of contemplation where we're doing some cleaning up of things that we're holding, we feel guilt about. So I'm just going to, there's so much that can be said about this, and yeah, I just want to also say one more thing, that sometimes we have been deeply hurt, and it's very hard to forgive, and we can't force ourselves to forgive. We may just open the door a tiny crack to the possibility that forgiveness could happen. So that is a one way of approaching forgiveness. And also, I want to distinguish between forgiveness and reconciliation. Forgiveness is when we accept that things happened as they happened. They just happened as they happened. And that's the way it was. And we're letting it go. We're accepting that our life unfolded in that way. There's a saying, forgiveness is giving up on having had a better past. You know, and it's funny because, you know, so many of us hold on to, if only my life had been like this or like that. And of course, that's just the way it was, and there's no going back, right? So we let go for ourselves so that we can be free of that holding on. Reconciliation is when we, with the other person, we come to an understanding that harm was done. And there's an admission, perhaps on one side or both sides, that harm was done. And we agree to reconcile. And there's a healing that can happen in a relationship. But that has to have the willingness of both parties to enter into that process. So we can forgive and at the same time know that there's no reconciliation. So I'm going to read a short prayer of forgiveness. And I don't know where this comes from. I just found it. And I'm going to pause after each line or after each stanza and just allow you time to, if you wish to repeat it or receive it. If I have harmed anyone in any way, either knowingly or unknowingly, through my own confusions, I ask their forgiveness. If anyone has harmed me in any way, either knowingly or unknowingly, through their own confusions, I forgive them. And if there is a situation I am not yet ready to forgive, I forgive myself for that. For all the ways that I harm myself, negate, doubt, belittle myself, judge, or be unkind to myself, through my own confusions, I forgive myself.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.